Okay, good morning, Rabbosai. We're going to begin Chazar Ashir for Contemporary Halacha Part 2. So, hopefully we have to be finished by 12 o'clock because I'm giving Shia 12 o'clock, so we don't have a choice. Let's start with Rabbi Willig's Shia of Zmani Hayom. There's a little bit of confusion about certain points, so we're going to put everything together. It'll be neat, easy, and loads of fun. So we have to start with a stira in Gemaras. There's a Gemara in Shabbos that says that Bein Hashmashos is 3/4 of a mil. If we assume that a mil is 18 minutes, so Bein Hashmashos is 13.5 minutes. That's 3/4 of a mil. And that starts at Shkia, and Bein Hashmashos ends, of course, with Seis HaKochavim. So therefore, we have 13.5 minutes of Bein Hashmashos. The problem is that there's another Gemara. The other Gemara says, Meforish, that Bein HaShemashos is 4 mil. So we have a steer whether Bein HaShemashos is 13.5 minutes, or 4 mil, which is 18 minutes times 4, 72 minutes. So there are two answers to that question. Rabbeinu Tam says that the way we look at Bein HaShemashos is as follows. Bein HaShemashos is 13.5 minutes. But it doesn't start when you think it starts. It starts 13.5 minutes before Tseis HaKochavim. Tseis HaKochavim is 4 mil. If I could just change one point. The second Gemara doesn't say that Bein HaShemashos is 4 mil. The second Gemara says that Shkia Til Tseis is 4 mil. So accordingly, Rabbeinu Tam says, the answer to the contradiction between these two Gemaras is that Tseis, of course, is 4 times 18, 72 minutes after Shkia. Bein HaShemashos is, well, 13.5 minutes. But it's 13.5 minutes before Tseis HaKochavim. So it comes out, according to Rabbeinu Tam, is you have Shkia, then you have 58.5 minutes that is still Yom Vadai, according to Rabbeinu Tam. Then Bein HaShemashos starts. It takes 13.5 minutes. That's from 58.5 until 72. And then at 72, you have Vadai Laila, which is Tseis HaKochavim. So from Shkia till 58.5 is Vadayom. From 58.5 till 72 is Bein HaShemashos, is Safek Yom, Safek Laila. And Tseis HaKochavim is Vaday Laila, that's Rabbeinu Tam's Shita. The Gra is much easier. The Gra simply says that there are two Gemaras. One says 13.5 minutes. The other Gemara says that Tseis HaKochavim is 72 minutes. That Gemara that talks about Tseis HaKochavim being at 72 minutes is just for astronomical purposes. It's not halachic. It's not nogea halacha l'maisa. If you wanted to ask an astronomer when stars come out, they'll tell you 72 minutes. But that second Gemara is not lehalacha. Lehalacha, all that we have to know, all that is a nogea for us, says the Gra, is that Bein HaShemashos is 13.5 minutes. Why did the Gra say that that has to be? Because the Gra is a very simple question on Rabbeinu Tam. Mr. Rabbeinu Tam, how could you say that Tseis HaKochavim, the stars come out after 72 minutes, we see stars come out much before that. And secondly, the Gra asks, according to the Rabbeinu Tam, that Tseis HaKochavim only starts when you actually see, that Laila only starts when you see the stars. Well, in the northern cities, when there are no stars, when you can't see the stars at all, you don't see the stars at all, they're never going to have Laila. So therefore, the Gra says it's always 13.5 minutes, because we look at it in Eretz Yisrael, will be 13.5 minutes, and we'll see how that applies to other locations in a few minutes. Now, let's talk about each shita separately for a minute. On the Gra, Rav Tukachinsky asks a very simple question. The 13.5 minutes that the Gemara talks about, presumably he's talking about Yerushalayim. The problem is in Yerushalayim, you don't have Tseis HaKochavim after 13 minutes. It takes 20-some-odd minutes for the stars to be visible after Shkia. So there are two answers to this question. Rav Tukachinsky is Mechadesh, that you're right, Bein HaShemashos starts at Shkia, Laila begins at 13.5 minutes. But there's another sheet of the Gemara that says that Tseis HaKochavim is later than when we assume Laila is. And Tseis HaKochavim depends not on 13.5 minutes, but on when you see the stars. So there are two different points here, according to Kaczynski. The reason why we assume Laila is 13, that Ben Hashemesh is 13 and a half minutes, is because we're not talking about when Tzeisa Kol Chavim is. It's not that Tzeisa Kol Chavim is 13 and a half minutes after Shkia. It's just that when Ben Hashemesh is over and Laila begins. Tzeisa Kol Chavim itself is a later point, is, let's say, 25 or so minutes after Shkia. That's what the Ritu Kaczynski suggests. But Reb Willig said that's you don't have to go that direction, which is a little bit schwer to assume that the 13 and a half minutes are not really when Tzeisa Kol Chavim begins. After the Gros sounds like he's saying that Tzeisa Kol Chavim is at 13 and a half minutes, not just Laila. So he quoted Dr. Levy, Dr. Levy from Machon Lev, that even though it takes our eyes, let's say 20, 25 minutes to see stars, a Baki could see stars already in 15 minutes, 40, whatever, closer to 13 and a half minutes. And therefore, what did the Gram mean when he said that Tzeisa Kol Chavim is 13 and a half minutes after Shkia? He meant that Tzeisa Kol Chavim to the eyes of a Baki is 13 and a half minutes. Okay, how do we get from, you know, we're closer to 15, closer to 13 and a half than 25. It's around that. So that's where we'll understand the Gra, that the Gra holds that Tzeisa Kol Chavim is when a Baki sees three stars, not when you and I see three stars. Because that Taka might be a bit later. That's the discussion of the Gra. Now let's talk about Rabbeinu Tam. Rabbeinu Tam said that it takes 72 minutes to get to Tzeisa Kol Chavim. And the question that the Gra asked on him was, Hachush Machish. We see stars well before 72 minutes. So Rav Druk in Oros Chaim answers, based on a Gemara, the Gemara says that you look at Tzeisa Kol Chavim facing, the question is what the Gemara means. We always understood that it means facing east. Now remember, I'm sorry, facing west. Remember, where does the sun set? In the west. So when are you going to see stars? Let me say the opposite. The Gemara says, Panam Ma'adimim Es HaMizrach, which simply means facing east. Facing east, that's where the sun rose. So in the east, it's much darker, much earlier, because the sun set in the west, so the light is still in the west. So if you face the east, you see stars very quickly. And that was the question of Rabbeinu Tam. Mr. Rabbeinu Tam, how could you say it takes 72 minutes in Yerushalayim? If I look, again, the sun set behind me, and I'm looking over there, it's darker there already, because the light was over there. So when I'm looking over there at the east, it's dark after 20 minutes or so. 25 minutes, I already see stars. Ah, says Rav Druk, the Gemara doesn't mean to look in the east, it means look in the west, where the sun was just setting, where the light was, and then it doesn't get darker till much later. That's how you could have Tzeisa Kol Chavim Taka at around 72 minutes. And in fact, if you do the real astronomy, you'll see that stars, if you look in the west side, you'll only see where the sun was, when the sun was just setting, stars will actually only appear at around 90 minutes. So that would be a defense to Rabbeinu Tam, how Tzeisa Kol Chavim could be so late. Correct. That was the Gra. This is a different point.
Sorry? 25 minutes is a kashim both them, we're just saying.
Yeah. Yeah, but the Rabbeinu Tam, right. Yes. Okay, the next point that we'll discuss, we had a question and answer for the Gra, question and answer for Rabbeinu Tam. Next point. What is the shear of a meal? Because we know that a meal is the basis that we're doing all of our math on. According to the Gra, it's 3/4 of a meal. Rabbeinu Tam is 4 a meal between Shkia and Tzeisa Kol Chavim. But what is a meal itself? So the Gemara tells us that a day, a person walks 10 parsos in a day. A parsa is 4 meal. So a person walks 40 meal in a day. So how do we figure out what a day is? Well, a day is 12 hours. A day is 12 hours. But when does that day start? When does it end? So if we assume that the day starts at Nates and finishes at Shkia, that's 12 hours. So 12 hours is 720 minutes. If we have 720 minutes and we figure out how many meal are in, if it takes 40 meal to walk in a day, if you could walk 40 meal in a day, that means it takes 12 hours, meaning 720 minutes, to walk 40 mil. If you walk 40 mil over 720 minutes, so how long did it take you to walk 1 mil? What's 720 divided by 40, or 72 divided by 4? 18 minutes. So this is the source for the 18-minute meal. However, if we say that we count if we say that we count the day, the 12 hours of the day, not from Netzachama till Shkia Sachama, but rather from Alos to Tzeis, listen to what we could come out with. Let's say we know that between, according to Rabbeinu Tam at least, we know that there are four meal between Shkia and Shkia Sachama and Tzeis HaKochavim, according to Rabbeinu Tam. We also know that there are four meal between Alos HaShachar and Alos HaShachar and Meitzachama. So that's four meal on each side. So that means I have from Neitz until Shkia is going to be not 40 mil, but 32 mil. Because if a person walks, if we assume that the person walks 40 mil in a day, and a day is the broader version of the day that starts at Alos HaShachar, and then it ends at Tzeis HaKochavim, and I have the 4 mil on each side from Alos HaShachar to Neitz, and that 4 mil at the end from Shkia till Tzeis HaKochavim, I'll end up with the 12 hours of Neitzachama to Shkia with only 32 mil to walk. So if I divide 720 minutes, the 12 hours from Neitz to Shkia, I divide it by 32, then I'll end up with a 22 and a half minute meal, and that's going to be the other shita of a meal. So what we just did, what we just suggested... Sure. What we're suggesting is that if we go like the Gra, we're going to come out with one number for the meal. If we go like Rabbeinu Tam, we're going to end up with a different number. If we go like the Gra just looks at Shkia and Neitz. If you want to know why he looks at Shkia to Neitz, the reason is because the Gra works with 13 and a half minutes, right, after Shkia. Is there any 13 and a half minutes that could happen before Neitz that is of any significance? No. So he's going to... So what's the middle? What's a day? A day is going to have to be not from 13 and a half minutes after Shkia, starting at 13 and a half minutes before Neitz. There's no such thing. So it must be the Gra looks at it from Neitz till Shkia. That's... Neitz till Shkia is 12 hours, 720 minutes, and it takes 40 mil to walk those 720 minutes. It takes 720 minutes to walk those 40 mil, and that's going to end up with 18. Good. But if you learn like Rabbeinu Tam, that says that there's 72 minutes after Shkia till Tzeis HaKochavim. Well, we do have a parallel in the morning. We have 72 minutes before Neitz is Alos HaShachar. So we could say that the midday will be balanced by the middle point between... We have a new way to look at things. We could say the day starts at... The day starts at 72 minutes before 4 mil before, and ends 4 mil after. So if you, but for some reason we're still assuming that the 40 mil that we walk is between Netzachama and Shkia. So therefore, the 40 mil that I walk, the 12 hours of the day are still between Netzachama and Shkia. So if I walked 4 mil from Alos HaShachar to Neitz, and I walk another 4 mil at the end of the day, from Shkia to Tzeis HaKochavim, I walk those 8 mil. So how many mil are left for me to walk from Neitzachama until Shkia? There are 32 mil for me to walk between Neitzachama and Shkia. And we assume that that is 12 hours, so it ends up that 12 hours, I could only walk 32 mil. If I walk 32 mil in 12 hours and 720 minutes. So how much is each mil going to be? 720 divided by 32 mil will be 22 and a half minutes. So that's Rabbi Willig's suggestion, that the 22 and a half minutes is going to be Rabbeinu Tam's shita in the number of a mil, while the Gra will assume that a mil will be 18 minutes. What? That's where he gets the 18 and a half. That's where he gets 18 from. Wait, I'm sorry.
4 mil times 22.5 is 19.
4 mil times 22.5 is 90. Yeah, we're going to talk about that in a minute. Yeah, that's what we're going to talk about that right now. Let's talk about, yes, to get that, we're going to talk about right now the Achtel, the Tzentel, the Zextel. I know a lot of people were thrown off with that. There are various, let's think of all the Chumras we could create for finishing Shabbos. Okay? So the first Chumra we'll do is going to go like Rabbeinu Tam, the simple reading of Rabbeinu Tam. We're going to wait 72 minutes. Okay? That's Chumra number one. But according to, like you just pointed out, according to the Cheshen that we just said, Rabbeinu Tam really holds that each meal is 22 and a half minutes, not 18. So what is 4 mil? The Gemara told us that Seisa Kachav is 4 mil after Shkia, and that's what Rabbeinu Tam learns. So if we assume that the meal is really not 18, but 22 and a half, which is longer, what's 4 mil going to be? 90. So that's a new Chumra. Really, if I'm going to be Machmir for Rabbeinu Tam after Shabbos, I'm not going to wait 72 minutes assuming that a meal is 18. I'll assume that a meal is 22 and a half, and I'll wait 90 minutes. What is 90 minutes? This Chumra called waiting 90 minutes, 90 into 720 is an achtel, is an eighth. Acht in Yiddish is eight, achtel, eighth. So that's what we call waiting an achtel. Somebody who waits an achtel is Machmir and waits 90 minutes. Now, if you want to know other Chumras, I could tell you other Chumras. What do we wait? If we want to be just go with the race straight Rabbeinu Tam. If we go straight Rabbeinu Tam, waiting 72 minutes after Shkia. Well, 72 minutes out of a day of 720 minutes is how much? 72 out of 720 is 1/10. That's a tenthel. A tenth. 10 is 10. That's a tenthel. So if you wait just Rabbeinu Tam, we'll call you waiting somebody who waits a tenthel. If you have this extra chumra of 90 minutes, we'll call you, like we mentioned a minute ago, an achtel. If you want to be the most chum, if you want to be as machmer as you can, the biggest brisk chum you could think of, well, you could assume that you could go like those shitas who hold that a meal is really that really you need 5 mil. There's another opinion in the Gemara that says that Seisa Kachav is 5 mil after Shkia. So if you take 5 mil, time and you multiply by the biggest size of a meal, which is 22 and a half, you're going to come out with 20, right, if you assume that a meal is 24 minutes, which is the biggest shita that there is, and you'll assume that there are 5 mil that you have to be concerned with between Shkia and Seis. So if you multiply 5 times 24, you're going to have 120 minutes between Shkia, according to this incredibly machmir opinion, and Seis HaKochavim. So that will be 120 minutes into 720. That would be a sixth of the day. That would be somebody's gigantic briska chumra waiting a zextel. Zex is six for Yiddish, zextel is sixth. A sixth of the day, waiting 120 minutes, that's the most chumra dikka opinion for waiting after Shabbos. That's the end of this point. Yes?
But didn't Rabbeinu Tam say that they were 72 minutes? Meaning if you were trying to say you were holding like Rabbeinu Tam, didn't he only say you were 72?
He did. The Gemara, though, said 4 mil. So it could be taken away at Tam Shita to its logical conclusion. Okay, next point. We just discussed how to figure out how long a meal is, how to figure out how long to wait, according to Rabbeinu Tam, that you have to wait 4 mil. Why don't you just walk 4 mil and figure out how long Rabbeinu Tam's 4 mil will be? Is it 72, or is it 90, or 100, whatever the different discussions we were just discussing, how long a meal is, walk for, or how long it takes. The Gemara said, Tosa says, we don't know who an Adam Beinoni is, so therefore we don't know, Tosa say, exactly how long these 4 mil is. Now, the Gra, again, so Tosis asked the question, why can't you measure just by walking 4 mil? Answer, Tosis answers, because we don't know who an Adam Beinoni is. The Gra says, I have a different answer. The reason why we don't just walk 4 mil is because 4 mil talks about a certain place at a certain time of the year. But if you had a different place, a different time of the year, then the numbers are going to be vastly different. The numbers are going to be elastic. But Tosis didn't say that answer of the Gra. That means Tosis must be assuming, said Rabbi Willig. If Tosis didn't say that it depends on what time of the year you're in, what season you're in, and it depends what latitude you're at, if Tosis didn't say that, that means Tosis is assuming that the number for the number for 4 mil, which we'll assume is 72, is a constant number that applies in all places, that applies all seasons of the year, and therefore, according to that reading in Tosos, 72 minutes is 72 minutes flat, regardless of whether stars are out, whether stars are not out, regardless of whether or not you're at this latitude or that latitude, and that will answer, Tosos L'shitasi, will answer the kasha the Gra asked on him earlier, that Hachush Machish, the stars aren't out at 72, but you see that the Tosos holds, I don't care if the stars are really out, I look just at the 72 minutes flat to define Tzeisel Kochavim, based on what it was in one location at one point in the year. That's another point. Just to Halach L'mayis, in terms of Rabbi Willick suggests, he says he certainly shouldn't do Melacha before 42 minutes after Shkia, but you should try to follow Ramosha. Ramosha is Rabbi Natan.
New York, correct?
New York. That you should try to do 50 minutes, and if you could do 60 minutes, that's great. You'll even have the Tosefes. That's ideal. That's Halach L'mayis. One last point in... 42 comes from applying the when Tzeisel Kochavim would be in the, when we would see three stars in the latitude of New York City at based on the latitude of New York City compared to the latitude of Yerushalayim. One last point in this shiur. Hold on. One last point in this shiur, and that's just in terms of Friday afternoons in shul. We know that there are different. There's a machlokas tanaim when mincha is until and when marav can begin. And the Gemara says, and we're allowed to follow different opinions. If you want to one day, you know, follow Rav Yehuda, one day follow Chachamim, go until one day you go daven until plaga mincha, another day daven until shkia. That's fine. But to do a tied to disaster on the same day, meaning to daven mincha after plaga mincha and daven marav before Shkia, which is what many shuls do during the summer, if they have like a 7 o'clock minyan during the summer, they're davening mincha after plaka mincha before Shkia, and davening mariv before Shkia. So it's a tata disasre that a person should avoid, and in such a case, daven early mincha. So it's before plug, so you could daven mariv after plug. And Rabbi Willick holds it would be better to daven b'yechidus than to daven this tata disasre. And if necessary, and if you're going to daven b'yechidus, the better one to daven b'yechidus is going to be is going to be Marev because it's a Rishus. If you can't, then better Daven Mincha B'Yechidus. That's our village Shita. That's the end of the Shir. Do you want brain death or mikvahs? I don't mind that you want brain death.
Shir.
Mikvahs? Who wants mikvahs? Mikvahs. Okay. There, just the one point that's important to know, halacha maisa, keep in mind that men's mikvahs are not mikvahs, usually. They're just filled with tap water, so, of course, do not do tefillas kelim in it, because kelim is tefillah d'oraisa that needs a mikvah that's kosher for anida, and not, therefore men's mikvah is not good for tefillas kelim. Okay, there are two kinds of mikvahs in the pasuk. Torah talks about a mikvah and a mayan. There are two main differences between a mikvah and a mayan. The first one is that a mikvah is metahir. Mikvah means gathered. That means the water is gathered. You have rainwater that's gathered one in a pit, a bar, and that's the Torah requires 40 sa'a of gathered water. As opposed to a ma'ayan, which is metahir b'kol shehu. That's one difference. The second difference between a mikvah and a ma'ayan is that a mikvah, in order to be metahir, must be ba'ashboren, it must be stagnant, non-moving water. However, a ma'ayan has a kula, that is metar afila bezochel, and even if the water is flowing. Now the Gra suggested that these two halachos, these two characteristics of a mikvah and a mayan, are hava hatalia. The Gra suggests as follows: that we know a mayan is flowing. We know that flowing water, besides whether flowing water is kosher or not, is flowing water mitz tarif to a shear? We have a din called katafris, which is flowing water on a hillside, on a slope. Katafris ain't a chibur. So flowing water is not connected one to another. So could you ever have a shear of flowing water? It's not shy to have a shear of flowing water, because flowing water doesn't, if you have water on a hillside, the water over here doesn't connect to the water over down below, which doesn't connect to the water down below, so you don't have the concept of a shear by flowing water. So therefore, a mayan, which is flowing, can't have a shear. You must, though, if mayan, which is zochalin, must be mitar b'kolshu, because you're never going to have a shear. That's the gross taliyah. Masha ain kain, a mikvah, which has a shear cannot flow. Because if it's going to flow, it's not mechubra one to the other, so there won't be a shear. So therefore, mikvah, which has a shear, must only be metahir be'ashborem as still water. That's the tliya that the Gra makes between these two halachas. Next point, what about different bodies of water? An ocean, the Shulchan Aruch says clearly that an ocean has a din of ma'ayon, and therefore it's metar even bezochelin, it's metar even b'mashahu. Next question, which is very nogei l'maisa, what about rivers and lakes? So, the Gemaras, we know that it should be dependent on what we just discussed. If a river or lake is a mikvah, then they're certainly big enough, but they'll be kosher only if they... Let me rephrase that. They'll be kosher only if they're stagnant. But if it's flowing like a river, rivers usually flow, many lakes also have outlets and are flowing, and therefore it will only be kosher if it's not rainwater, but if it's spring water, if it's mayan water. So therefore, the Gemara has the following machlokas. If I see a river, which of course is flowing, do I know what it is? Well, says the Gemara the following. One opinion is that it depends on what time of the year. In the, when is there a lot of water? The water comes down during the winter. All the snow falls, and then the snow melts. So in the spring, you have a lot of water that's coming from rain that melted. Snow melted from the mountains, came down to the riverbed, and flows. All the water that I have is geshamim, megeshamim, the rov is megeshamim. So therefore, if it's megeshamim, that means it has a din mikvah. If it has a din mikvah, then it's pasul if it flows. And therefore, you cannot go to the mikvah in the spring. But in the fall, where all the water, where's the water in the river from if you're in the fall? Many months after all the rainwater has come down. It must not be rainwater. Whatever river, water is flowing in a river during the fall season is probably from a spring at the top of the river. So therefore, during the fall, which when you have spring water, it's a mayan. Mayan, oh, it's flowing, that's kosher. A mayan is kosher, bezochelin. That's one opinion in the Gemara. That it depends on which season, and only when it's majority rainwater, that's when it's going to be, then a river will be possible. But if it's majority mayan water, then it will be kosher. Shmuel, on the other hand, for whatever complicated reason, says, no, all lakes, all rivers are always kosher, for whatever reason. Now, the Shulchan Aruch is machmir, not like Shmuel, and paskins that you have to follow whatever the rove of the water is. And therefore, it will depend on the season. If you're after rainy season and the water is rain, it's going to be pasul, because it's zochel, it's flowing. And rainwater, mikvah water, is rainwater is for a mikvah, that is pasul v'zochel. And during the dry season, when the majority is mayan, it will be kosher. However, the Rama quotes the Yesh Mekilin that you can, that if there are no mikvahs around, you can rely on the other opinion in the Gemara on Shmuel, and you are allowed to be tovel in a river or a lake all year long. It is important kula from Rav Avadya. Rav Avadya Yosef says that the one who gives this Yesh Mekilin in the Ramah was the Maharik. The Maharik himself is a Sephardi. That means the kula of the Ramah that allowed you, B'shat Sadchak, to be tovel all year long in a river was himself a Sephardi, and therefore even Sephardim could rely on this kula of the Ramah and be tovel in a river all year long if there's no other choice. We mentioned that a mikveh is possible if there's zechila, if the water flows. What is the, how much flowing is flowing? So here we have a Rashba. The Rashba is Mekel and says that a mikveh is only possible if it's zechila hanikeres, recognizable flowing. The Gra, however, the Gra and Shulchan Aruch is machmer that even a zechila she'en hanikeres is going to be possible mide oraisa. So that's something that we have to be concerned with. Halach l'maisa.
Who's the second one?
The Gra on the Shulchan Aruch. The Halach l'maisa, we assume that if the water level loses 4 inches over a period of 24 hours, that's going to be a problem of Zechila. That's whatever this, I guess that's, I don't know if they call that Nikeres or any Nikeres, but that's l'maisa, that's what we try to assume. But of course, you have to keep in mind that every time a person goes in, there's going to be some water coming out because of displacement, because of the water that's dripping off their body. So it might be a little bit more than that. That's not a function of the mikvah might lose a little more than that, but that's not because of zechila. That's just because of evaporation and water on bodies that's coming out. Just keep in mind. Now, let's talk about the different ways to construct the mikvah. New point. There are two ways to construct a mikvah. That's hashaka and zriya. What is hashaka? Hashaka is it's a kiss. I have a kosher bar that has made geshem, that fell down into this bar. And now I have a bar of tap water. I open up a hole between the two so the two waters could kiss, could have a nishika. That's hashaka. I just kashered the tap water. That hole has to be shofaris hanod, which is around 2, according to others, 3 inches, in that hole that connects where the two waters kiss. Very important question is, once that hashaka happened, could I plug up the hashaka and now just have 2 kosher boros? Or does the hashaka have to be open during the tevila so that when she goes in the tap water, it's still right now connected while she's being tevelas to the bor geshem? So Shulchan Aruch is mekel, and you could be tovel even if it's plugged up, but the bach is machmir to have it open during the tevila. That's hashaka. Zriya is a different halacha. Zriya means that you pour, you have a bor full of mei geshamim, and then you just turn the tap water right into that, and you overflow it into the next adjacent bor, so you sort of planted the tap water into the first bor of mei geshem, it flows over, and ends up being in the second bor tevila. That's what zriya is. And according to, when you have zriya, all the water first fell into the mei geshem, and then just rolled over into the next bor, you don't need any hashaka whatsoever. That sounds great, because you never have to worry about, did I forget to open up that plug to be mashed the two waters? In other words, when you have hashaka, there's always a concern that maybe the mikvah lady forgot to unplug when they put in new water in the tap water, the bar tevila, maybe the mikvah lady forgot to unplug it and connect it to the bar geshem. With zri, you never have that problem, because you never have water in the bar tevila in the first place, unless you already poured it and were mashed the water by pouring it into the bar geshem before it got to the bar tefila. However, the bar zriya does itself have a problem, because what happens with the bar zriya is that you have the tap water which you suck it out, and then you're going to put new water in it. That itself is a problem, because whenever you have something that's an empty bar, that now you pour mei geshem into it, if there was a little bit of water left on the bottom when you suctioned it out, and then you put your mikvah on top of that, if there's a certain shear, gimel lugin of she'uvim on the bottom, then whatever you pour on top is not going to make it into a mikvah. And therefore, we have to be worried when you do a zriya, if you're never going to be connecting the two mikvahs to be mashir the bor tefila through a shofar hanod, through the hashaka, then if you're only relying on water pouring in from the top, if there was a little water on the bottom, before the new mei geshamim, the tap water went into the mei geshamim and now overflowed into your bar tefila, came in, you might end up with a pasul mikvah because there might have been water on the bottom before mei shuvim, before you started your zriya.
Why would that's in the bor that holds the tap water, the second bor, why would there be mei shuvim?
Because let's say you suctioned out yesterday's water and you didn't suction every last ounce out. Yesterday's water
got there through Zriya. So
got there through Zriya, you're right. So let's say
the problem we mentioned with the Bor Zriya, if I remember from Shir, was that you're not going to have the Shach's Chumra of keeping
that as well. This is a separate thing.
Maybe if they clean it out in between.
Right. It could be hose water. Thank you. If they clean it out, there's hose water on the bottom. Thank you. Not if it's from yesterday, it'll be fine. If it's hose water for cleaning it out, then it'll be a problem. Thank you for clarifying. Shlosha gimel lugin.
Is that very small? Why is it an issue?
Revius is a revius halug, right? So revius halug, if you assume revius is a 3.5 ounces, so full lug is 3.5 times 4 is 15-ish. And so 60 ounces, 45 ounces, right? It's not so big. Okay, there is a problem with hashaka Because there are some Rishonim who say that in order to do a Hashaka, you have to do a complete mixing. A little hole that's Shafaris Hanod, that's not going to be enough to do a Hashaka between two mikvahs, and therefore you have to have a complete mixing. So that's one other disadvantage of Hashaka. Another problem that we have with Zriya is that whenever you do Zriya, we mentioned before, 5 minutes ago, that every mikveh is pasul b'zochelin. It can't be flowing. So how do you make a Zriya? You pour water in one bore and it flows over to the next bore. So as you're having the water go from one to the other, it's flowing. So that is being zochel. So how could you create a mikveh that is going to be kosher if you created it by having flowing water flow from the more bor geshem and you've poured water onto it, just flows straight out. So the Chazon Ish suggests to solve that problem that if you put the water, the new tap water for Zriya, if you put the new tap water underneath at a low, let it fall into a low point in the Bor Geshem, so it will sort of go into the Bor Geshem, and only after the Bor Geshem fills up a little bit more, it will flow over the tap into the Bor Tefila. You don't have a situation of water that's just flowing out. You have water that's completely Nizra, was Huchsho Legamre, and then only afterwards water flows out. It was already, the water was already Huchshar as May Mikvah. That was the Chazon Ish's solution. That's Zriya and Hashaka with the various problems and advantages of each. There is another issue, new point, and that's a psul called Nasan Sa V'Natal Sa, which is that if you have a kosher mikveh, and then you add a gallon, take out a gallon, add a gallon, and take out a gallon, add a gallon, and take out a gallon, so you still have your 40, you still have 40 sa, but that 40 sa is no longer 40 sa of Mei Geshem, is that a problem? So Moses showed him that that's okay. However, there's a shach who's machmir for Rambam and Ravid that it is a problem, and you always want your mikveh to stay Rov Geshem. So if you want your mikveh to stay Rov Geshem, that's great. Go into a mikveh that's Rov Geshem. The problem is, we want our women to go into mikvahs that are clean, so they want to go into tap water. So if you have Hashaka, then that's great. You'll be machshu your tap water, but if you leave it open to be machmir for the shach, you leave the Hashaka open to be machmir for the shach, the water is going to eventually, if you leave it open the whole time, the water is just eventually going to travel back and forth, and you no longer have your rov mei geshem to avoid the problem natal sa v'nasan sa v'natal sa. So the solution to this was the Rebbe Rishab's bor al gabe bor. What he did, again, what is he trying to have? He's trying to have that there will always be rov geshem in the, at least one of the boros, and you'll connect where you'll be tovel to that Rov Geshem. How do you keep Rov Geshem? Mikvahs are heated, usually. So if you have cold water, that's colder, it's more dense, it stays on the bottom. So if you have a bar all the way on the bottom, and right on top of it, then you have a floor, or a ceiling on top of that bar, that's going to be cold rainwater. It's going to stay there because it's cold and dense, it's going to stay down there. You put a hole in that roof, and you have your next mikvah right on top of that, which is going to be warm water for people to be tovel in. So you'll have that hole there, so people will be tovel in the top mikvah. The top mikvah will have a hole and therefore be connected to the bottom mikvah. But the cold water, the regeshem, will stay below. And the hot water will stay where people will be tovel. The tap water will stay on top. So you have a hashaka. The hashaka will stay open, so you'll have the advantage of the shach, that the nekev has to be unplugged. Yet you'll still have the rov geshem staying there. The problem is that the Divrei Chaim, the Sanz Rebbe, asked that we have an explicit Mishnah that says that if you have a vertical connection, what we call katafras, if you have a connection between water that is not just side by side, but it's one on top of the other, or on a slope, or one on top of the other, that is not connected at all. So everything that the Rebbe Rashab tried to accomplish, of having one mikvah on top of the other mikvah, that's pasul legamri, because there is no connection of the upper mikvah to the Mei Geshem beneath it, because it's a vertical, there's a whole vertical hole, and that's Ketafras and a Chibur. Anything that, any connection between waters that's on a slope, on a slant, or one on top of the other, that's not a Chibur at all. And therefore, the Devi Chaim suggested a more complicated mikvah, which would be that you have a, you could do the Rebbe Rashab one on top of the other at once. And then next to that, not on top, but next to that, you put a bar tefillah where the person will actually, you put a bar tefillah where a person will be tovel, and that will be, you'll have a horizontal hashaka. The Divrei Chaim, or that's what people say to solve the Divrei Chaim's problem. Two last points regarding the Kvos, and that is Hamshacha. Hamshacha is when you run water 3 tvachim along the ground. So we assume there are shittas who hold that the Gemara says that if you have she'uvim that runs 3 tvachim along the ground, it loses its psil of she'uvim, and it becomes kosher. Now, there's a machlokas, if it just took away the psil de oraisa, if you run water gimel tvachim along the ground, you do hamshach, did that just take the psil de oraisa away from she'uvim, or did it make the mikvah mutter lechatchila, and there is one shita, the rif, that's not accepted in general, but there is the sheet of the Rif who says that if you do hamshacha, you took its mutter legamre to kasher she'uvim. So according to the Rif, if you could take your tap water, instead of pouring it into the mikvah, pour it 3 tvachim away from the mikvah, let it run on a little bit of concrete for 3 tvachim, okay. And then roll it. What? They put sand or pebbles there. I'm not sure why it has to be the karka, fine. Maybe the karka is not enough. It will be run over karka for 3 tvachim. Then it will fall into your mikvah, and you just made a kosher mikvah, according to the Rif, with a faucet. Obviously, we're not going to rely on that Rif, but at least on some level, whenever you do hamshacha, at least according to the Rif, you have a kosher mikvah. Last point in mikvahs is, can you make a mikvah out of snow? The Shulchan Aruch is Mekel, the Shach rejects it. And the advantage that you have of putting snow is that you can put snow into a kli. A kli does not make snow she'uvim. So there are two issues. Could a mikvah be kosher with snow? That's A. Secondly, if I am not... What? The Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch says I can make a mikvah out of snow. Secondly, the Shach is Machmir. Secondly, what that Shulchan Aruch is saying is that if I put snow into a kli, that does not make it into she'uvim, because snow does not take the shape of the kli. Water takes the shape of the kli, and therefore will become she'uvim, but snow will not take the shape of the kli, therefore will not become she'uvim. That is mikvahs. Next topic, we want to do brain death or genetics in halacha. Just call out what you want.
Genetics.
Let's leave it for later. Yes, we're just not going to... Okay, there are, I think, 2 points to know from Dr. Reichman's shiur about genetics. That is, regarding amniocentesis, and if somebody has, God forbid, if it's a family that has Tay-Sachs in the genes, they want to do test the fetus to see if there is a Tay-Sachs situation. Could they do amniocentesis, which involves taking a needle, sticking it through the woman's stomach, getting a little bit of the liquid from the amniotic fluid, and testing that amniotic fluid. So, is that a problem, or is that okay, or is there a violation of Talmud Tiyam Hashem Elokecha? So, Ramosha says that since it's something that's so easy to do, not that we would want needles going into our stomach, but since it's so easy to do, relatively, and you don't do it, it's like closing your eyes to something that you could see. So, therefore, that's not a violation of Talmud Tiyam Hashem Elokecha. So, therefore, you should be able to. I'm sorry, I take this back. He's not talking about amniocentesis. Ramosha was talking about taking Tay-Sachs tests in general. I'm sorry, take that back. We'll talk about amniocentesis in a minute. Again, Ramosha was asked, can we do Dor Yesharim? He said, of course you could do Dor Yesharim. All it takes is a little, I don't know, is it a blood test or a cheap swab? Blood test, right? A little blood test, and you could find out if a person's a carrier. That's not a violation of Tamim Tiyam Hashem Elokecha. Next point, let's say a family didn't test for Dor Yesharim. Can they now do an amniocentesis to see if the baby has any issues? So here, Ramosha says, because their goal would be that if there would be a Tay-Sachs indicator, then they would abort. if it's a positive result on the amniocentesis. So Moshe says, well, abortion is kein ritzicha, and therefore, abortion is ritzicha for a guy, it's ritzicha for us, and therefore, what's the point of an amniocentesis if all you could do with it is see if you want to abort, which is ritzicha. So therefore, there's no point in doing an amniocentesis in such a case. However, the Tzitz Eliezer is an opposite extreme. He basically says you could abort till, he says, even until the seventh month, which is illegal even in America, which allows abortion in many places. So according to Tzitz Eliezer, of course you can do an amniocentesis because it's a very productive goal. You might see that this baby doesn't work for you, but this, it might be something that the person, the family doesn't want to have, and therefore they could abort it even until a late period. Now, neither of these, this shaila doesn't have to come up, because if a family got married and they have this Tay-Sachs issue with them, between them, then there's always PGD, which is they could check the genes before it's created, before the fetus is created, and see if those genes that the baby is being made of is going to be carrying Tay-Sachs. That's one issue. Now, next issue. Now that we have PGD, pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, that you could find out things from the genes even before you have the baby, just by checking the cells, could we use it to? Could we use PGD to select what kind of child we want? And there are lots of applications you could have it. You could have it if you want to make sure that your firstborn will be a bachor, so you could have a boy, so you could have Hidon HaBen. No one's going to be mekel there. If there's a Kohen and a wife who got a hetzer to use donor sperm, so they want to use PGD so that it won't be a boy. Because if it will be a boy, the kid's not going to be a Kohen, and they don't want the kid to be embarrassed. So could they use PGD there to make sure there will be a girl? Or other such questions. So those are all discussed by the poskim. And the Nishmas Avram cites both Rabbi Yasha and Rabbi Neuwirth that it is permitted in certain cases to do PGD for Tay-Sachs. They'll permit PGD to make sure the baby doesn't have Tay-Sachs. That brings us to a second question, the final point in this year, two more points. The next point in this year will be that what do you do with excess embryos? And this is a question that both for PGD and whenever they have when they have IVF, you sometimes create number of embryos and then you implant the one that will be most, that seems to be most successful, one that's doing well. So what do you do with the extra embryos that you're not planning to implant? Could you just throw them away or not? So Rebbe Yashiv suggested that any embryo that was outside of a uterus and never implanted in a uterus, that never became a nefesh, so it's not ritzicha. Maybe it's hashchas zera, that's something to talk about, which perhaps for Puravru we might permit, but the Catholic Church holds that throwing away embryos is ritzicha, as does Lahavdil, Alfi Avdil, also by Bleich, that throwing away those extra embryos is murder.
Is it for goyim?
I assume in this sugya goyim are more chamer. I would assume. In abortion, the halacha is for goyim are more chamer, and this is not really, it's either abortion or tzicha. Goyim are equally obligated in tzicha, and they're more obligated in abortion. So I would assume so. Of course, there's no chiyuv to have any PGD or sperm freezing or all the other things to have babies to fulfill Mr. Puravu. The question, all these shailas are, if a person wants to, do they have the het, the various heterim for Puravu? That's what all the posts can discuss. The last point in this year was if a person knows that they have a genetic sickness, do they nevertheless have to fulfill the mitzvah of Puravu? Are they nevertheless obligated to Puravu? The answer is yes. Bahadi Kivsha Drachmana Lamalach, like the Gemara talks about the story that who was it? Yechezkel? Chizkiah, I'm sorry. Chizkiah knew that he was going to have Risham come from him, and therefore he didn't want to have babies. Hashem was angry at him. It's none of your business. You do what you have to do, and let Hashem do what he has to do. And therefore, Moshe Feinstein Paskin is that a person with Marfan's syndrome does have to try to find a wife with whom he could have children, if no one who is of childbearing ability wants to marry him, okay, so he could get married to somebody else. But if he can, he should try to have children. That's the end of that year. Next year, do you want to do Dina de Malchus Adina, or do you want to do Brain Death?
Brain
Who wants to do it? Now we're on the topic. Okay, let's do Brain Death. So, first important, I think Rabbi Shabtai did a fabulous job of putting down the Hagdar to start the Shir with. Brain death is not a halakhic, brain death is not a medical issue whatsoever, at least from our perspective. Defining the moment of death has nothing to do with medicine. It has to do with, there's something called life, so you need a value system to figure out what life is and what life isn't. That has nothing to do with medicine. Medicine will tell you where you are along the spectrum of life, of physiological activity, but at which point we define that to be the cutoff of what is life and what isn't life, that has nothing to do with medicine. I think that's a very important starting point. Okay. There are two points that we have to know in this shir. The first is there are two Gemara, two sources that we have to deal with. We'll deal with them separately. The first is the Gemara talks about Mefatkenes Hagal and Shabbos. If there's a building collapses, you have to save people, so you save them on Shabbos, even if there's a suffix. But if you see that they're dead, so you're not going to continue to violate Shabbos to save dead bodies. So how do you know? Is there a way, if you come across a body that's not moving much, or at all, should you continue to get all the rubble, bring the bulldozers and the trucks and the cranes to save this body? So the Gemara says, Ad heichan hu bodek, machlokas tanaim, I'm assuming, ad chotmo, or ad libo. So if we stop here, it sounds like the Machlok Gemara has a question. How much do you have to check to see if he's alive or dead? If he's alive, you're not going to... You'll continue the excavation. If he's dead, you don't have... You're not allowed to continue to excavate on Shabbos. So one opinion says that you check libo, you check if there's a heartbeat. The other opinion says you should check ad chotmo, see if there's breath coming out of his nostrils, if he's breathing. Which one is first, which one is last? So the heart the heart beats even after the body, even after a person stops breathing, the heart continue to beat. So the Machlokas is saying, the first, if we would just look at the Gemara, you should check if he's breathing or not. That's the first opinion. And the second opinion says, even if he's not breathing, which will mean that there is probably brain death, the heart could still be pumping. And therefore, check his heart. Now that will be a machlokas. All the Rishonim, though, paskin in this machlokas, that we follow chotmo, which means we follow breathing. So if we stop here, just by reading the words of the Gemara, it sounds like, and this is what the Rabbanut takes, that when a person stops breathing, they are dead, which will end up meaning that a brain-dead person is dead, even though the heart is still beating, and therefore the Rabbanut would allow you to take that beating heart out of this brain-dead person who's not breathing and transplant it, because that person is dead even though their heart is beating. The problem is, there are no real Rishonim on this sugya except for Rashi. And Rashi doesn't learn like that. Rashi learns that this machlokas is not a machlokas of when is a person dead. Rather, it's... saying, how do you check if there is a heartbeat? The first opinion says that, how do you check a heartbeat? You look at their chest and see if their heart is beating. If there's no heartbeat, then you could assume that they are dead if you look at their chest. If you look at their chest and there is a heartbeat, then you know that they're alive. The second opinion says, that's not enough to check. It's not enough just to look at the heart, see if the heart is beating. You have to look at the mouth to see if there's breathing, because if there's breathing, then you know that his heart is still beating. So Rashi clearly says, and Rashi is the only reason that we have on this Gemara, that what defines that the Gemara that we just mentioned is not telling you when there's death. It's not a machlokas tanam about what is dead, what is not dead. Rather, it's telling you how to tell whether a person has a heartbeat or doesn't have a heartbeat. One Tana says, look at his heart. The other Tanya says, that's not enough. You have to look at his chotem. And we pass in like that second opinion that you have to look at his chotem. That means it's not enough to check his heart if there's a heartbeat. You have to check if there's breathing, which would then tell you that there must have been a heartbeat. Therefore, all the people who say that brain death is not death are the people who learn the Gemara with Rashi. And therefore, I'm saying it a little more simplified than it is, but therefore, if you look at Rashi, and some of this is how the Chacham Sui understands Rashi, and the Chasam Sofer probably understood Rashi, the Rashi is, again, not learning this machlokas of what is death. Everyone agrees that death is, both Tanam agree that death is the heartbeat. It's just a question of how do you measure whether or not there is a heartbeat. And therefore, according to this, according to the Rashi, which is the only reason that we have on the Sugya, Rashi understood that if the heart is beating, the person is still alive. Whether they're brain dead or not brain dead, their heart still is beating. Therefore, if you were to take a beating heart out of a body, that it would be called Ritzicha. And therefore, brain death is not death. And you cannot do live organ transplants from a body that has a beating heart.
So if you could please clarify, you mean Rashi's the only Rishon who's Mefarish to Sugya, because you said the Rabbanut, or similar from the fact that Rov Rishon and Paskim Chokmah, and then you said Rashi's the only Rishon on Sugya.
Right.
Meaning Rashi, all the Paskim
in terms of explaining what the Shaka Vatari is, what is the Machlokas, Rashi is the... There's not other shitas about what the machlokas is. We know how to paskin. They tell us how to paskin the machlokas. But what is the machlokas about? What are they arguing about? We know it's one shita, it's ad chotmo. What are they discussing about chotmo? Are they discussing that chotmo is death and not death? Or are they discussing, Rashi says, how to determine whether his heart is still beating or not beating by checking the chotem? Thank you. That was one sigya. The second half of the shir, we're dealing with a different makar in the sugya of death, and that's the Mishan Ahalos. The Mishan Ahalos says, of course, Ahalos, we're talking about Tumas Meis, and Tumas Meis only starts once a person is dead. So when is a person dead? Well, the Mishnah says, among other things, if a person is decapitated, then even if their body is moving around, they're still dead. And therefore, their tame, even though the body is still jumping around, so if you would have a kli that's in the room, or if you're in a room, if there's a kohen in the room, and the body's still jumping, it was decapitated, the body's still jumping around, the kohen jumps out, he's still tame. Because he was there, but the body was jumping around, no, the person is still dead once there's a decapitation. Now we're going to have four ways to understand this Mishnah. This Rabbi Bleich understands, Rabbi Schefter seemingly also understands, that this Mishnah actually is going to be a source to tell you that brain death is not death, and therefore organ donation would not be allowed. How does that work? Because the Mishnah is telling you, you have a body, and it's dead, not dead. Well, there's motion. You might think that that motion means that it's still alive. Kamash Malon, the Mishnah comes and tells you, this is not the motion that makes it still alive. Pirchus, the jumping around, the twitching, the nervous twitching of the limbs after death doesn't make it alive. Which means what? Which means that any other motion that the body would have, any other motion of vitality of life that the body has, for example, a heartbeat, or any other motion that the body would have, means you're still alive. The Mishnah is telling you a chiddush. The Mishnah is telling you the body is moving and you're still dead. Which would mean any other motion besides this nervous twitch that a decapitated, organism goes through is, yes, life. And therefore, the Mishnah has to tell you that this is not life. So therefore, this Mishnah would be a source for many poskim to say that organ that brain death is not death, because as long as there's any movement, significant vital movement to the body, like a heartbeat, for example, that's certainly a significant vital movement, their body is still alive. Except for this, the Mishnah says, which is when the body has been decapitated and the limbs are twitching. The Rabbanut looks at this Mishnah. Again, the Rabbanut are the ones who say that brain death would be death. So they look at this Mishnah and they say, oh, when are you dead? You're dead when you're not breathing anymore. And therefore, even if the heart is beating, so of course, once you cut off the head, you know where your tummy? Because you're not breathing anymore. So That's how they will understand this Mishnah. Very simple problem. We know a lot of people who are not able to breathe. All the people who had iron lungs when there was polio in the last century, Christopher Reeve, was not able to breathe on his own. So you're telling me that they're all dead, even though they're living somewhat fulfilled lives? They're all dead because they're not breathing anymore? And that's going to be very difficult on this Shita. The third Mahalach in how to understand this Mishnah is Rav Tevna's Mahalach. Rav Tevna suggests he couldn't go with the simple reading that if you're not breathing, you're dead, because we know that there are plenty of people like Christopher Reeve and all the people who were on iron lungs and weren't breathing by themselves were still alive. So he suggested a twist. He suggested that this Mishnah is telling you that when the brain is doing its job of keeping the body together, keeping the body integrated, that's when the person's alive. When the brain is either chopped off, or it's not chopped off, but it's no longer doing its job of integrating the whole body system together, all the body systems together, then the person will be dead. So therefore, in Christopher Reeve's situation, his brain was keeping the whole body together, so he's still alive, even though he wasn't breathing. The problem with that suggestion is that there's a government, NIH study that said that that's not true. That even if there is no brain functioning, the body could still be working as an integrated whole. So therefore, that's just not true. The fourth shita in understanding this Mishnah is that of Rav Shlomo Zalman. Rav Shlomo Zalman presumably agrees, like we said in the first Mahalach with Rav Bleich and Rav Shechter, that brain death is not death, and therefore you have to, as long as the heart is beating, the person's still alive. And you see that from the fact that the Mishnah says that the body, as long as there's still vital motion means anything that's moving that's helping the body live, like a heartbeat, the person is still 100% alive. But the Mishnah is being mechadesh a new point to us. Either, what is death? Death is, well, like we've always been assuming, that when there's nothing happening, there's no breathing, no heartbeat, no absolutely nothing, even if there's a heartbeat, which is the last thing to go, then they're alive. Once the heartbeat is gone, there's no more motion, then the person's dead. And, says Rav Shlomo Zalman, this Mishnah adds to you another place to find that somebody's dead. Even if there are lots of things happening, but the person was decapitated. So the Mishnah is being mechadish to you a new way to determine death. There's a regular death, and that is like the sugya that we saw, that whenever there's no more movement, there's no heartbeat, then the person's complete dead as a doorknob, then they're dead. This Mishnah comes and says, you know what, I'll tell you there's another way that a person could become dead, and that's by having his head chopped off. And then even if all kinds of things are working, he's still dead. That's how Rav Shlomo Zalman understands. So putting it all together, there are basically two main points that you have to hear. One main point, that the Mishnah that says that a person is dead after that the nervous twitch that the limbs go through after he's been decapitated might be a very good source for those who say that brain death is not death, because this Mishnah is telling you that even though there is a certain motion, meaning the twitching of the decapitated body, that's not called life. Which sounds like any other movement would be called life. And therefore, if there would be a heartbeat, the person would be alive, and you cannot take his organs. Okay. We have just two more shiurim to go through.
I'm going to wait until I can print up electricity.
Okay, let's see. Do we want Dina de Machusa, or do we want Yichud? Dina de Machusa, I think was a hard shiurim. Okay. So, in Rav Shechter's Dina de Machus Hashir, the first point he just pointed out is obviously it's Dina de Machus will only be Dina if it is fair. If it's not fair, if it's discriminatory, then it's not Dina, but it's Gazlanusa de Machus. Okay, put that aside. What? So in the Shir he said it Avsanusa, but in his article, the RJJ Journal in Volume 1, he called it Gazlanusa. So, Chasnusa, Chasnusa, those are the two words he used in his article, and then Shir, he said Chasnusa, yeah, so. I think I just heard wrong, because that's why I corrected my notes based on the article. Okay. What's the source for Dina de Malchus? Dina, there are two shitas, at least two, probably many more, two famous shitas in the Rishon. The way that Rabbi Shadda seems to assume that we paskin like is the shita of the Be'er HaGra, the Meiri, and that's the Gemara in Sanhedrin, Parshas HaMelech. There's a machlokas, Rabbi Shmuel, whether when Shmuel HaNavi tells Bnei Yisrael, what a melech, you want a melech, a melech could do all kinds of things, he could do this to you and this to you, and he could give you taxes, so there's a machlokas. Shmuel says, all the things that Shmuel HaNavi was telling Bnei Yisrael are things that a melech is actually permitted to do. Rav said, no, Shmuel HaNavi is just trying to frighten them, la'ayim, lo nemra pashizu ela la'ayim aleihem. To scare them, you really want a king? He might do this or this. Not necessarily that a king has the rishus to do it, but this is what kings do. We paskin, like the first opinion, like Shmuel, that kol ha'amr b'parashas ha'melech, melech mutar bo, and therefore a melech has a right to levy tax, and this clearly is talking about even under Jewish rule, even in Eretz Yisrael, and that's how Rosh Hashanah understands the Pesach of the Shulchan Aruch to be. That a melech can levy tax, even in Eretz Yisrael. There's, of course, the famous Ran Sanhedrin, which Rosh Hashanah to point out is not even cited as a Yesh Omrim in the Shulchan Aruch, that the right to levy tax is nothing to do with Parshas HaMelech, but rather taxation is nothing more than the right of the king to charge rent on his land. And therefore, if the king could always throw you out if you don't pay rent, so you have to pay rent, because others will throw you out. Oh, some people say, but in Eretz Yisrael, where it's Likol Haaretz, it's Hashem's land, what?
The Ran went to himself.
The Ran himself applies a thank you, Likol Haaretz, then we will not be, we can't be thrown out, so therefore the Melech doesn't have the right, you don't have to pay the taxes for rent if it's not the Melech's land to charge rent on. Now, there is an opinion, just to know, in the article mentioned that the Beis Shmuel says that Dina de Malchus HaDina is only Drabbanon, but most reject this and assume that Dina de Malchus HaDina is Taka Midaraisa. Rav Schechter has a different take on the concept of taxes, and that is that we see that taxes might not go with the regular din of Dina de Malchus HaDina. Dina de Malchus HaDina is, does a Melech have a right just to raise money for himself if he wants to make money? But in democracies and the governments that we're more familiar with, there's a different sugya to discuss, and that's the sugya in Hilchos Shutvin, that if you have people in an area who share a certain need, they're, by default, automatically joined together in a shutfus, and even if they never made an agreement between them, and Tosefta says that we follow the rove of the shutfus. And therefore, if there are 100 people in a little village, and 70% of them have a certain need, then that de facto shutfus, this village has the right to get the money that it needs for this need that 70% of its inhabitants have. So similarly, we have shutfuses. Our city has a shutfus. We have shutfus with the people in our state, with the people in the United States of Gemara, in the United States of America, and therefore taxes in our kinds of country is not al tzdina d'machlus dina, but it's al to enrich a king who's not giving us anything. It's rather as part of our shutfus to provide the needs of the majority of the country. So, for example, if there are many people in New York City who need to go to public schools, so even though I choose to send my children to a private school, I might still be bound to the city, to that shutfus of New York City, that will obligate me to pay tax, a hefty sum of taxes to go to public education. Accordingly, this, even if one would want to hold like that Ron that we mentioned earlier, as Rabbi Schechter understands, that Ron would not apply in the nature of taxes as we see it. Now, I hear your point. Okay, next point that we'll talk about is how far does Dina de Malchus HaDina go? So, without getting into details, he suggests maybe it would apply to red lights and green lights, perhaps it would apply for speeding for whatever reasons. The Shach says that Dina de Malchus not only apply, it certainly doesn't apply to Isser. Like, if they say you could divorce in this way, we're not going to be able to use civil divorce. Of course, it applies to mamonos. But the Shach points out a very important point, that din machusa is what makes money into money. And therefore, in all those cases where halacha requires legal tender, in all those cases where shava kesef is eina kekesef, there what makes kesef into kesef, that is whatever the law of the land defines as legal tender. And therefore, for example, by pidyon ma'aser sheni, where you need bedavka kesef, where either the person where you're doing the pidyon has to be, if you have, for example, the person doing the pidyon is in a place where something is kesef, or the fruits are somewhere where it's kesef, that a person could be poda onto that ma'aser sheni. But if a person is being poda his fruits that are not in, let's say a person in America is being poda his fruits in it, I'm sorry, let's say a person in America is being poda the Jaffa oranges that he bought at the store, but his pruta is a pruta. So since both he and his Jaffa oranges are in America, that pruta is not legal tender, and therefore he will not be able to be mechel do his pidyon ma'aser sheni onto that pruta chamura that he has, because it's not legal tender. Shekel is not legal tender here. We have to also mention in passing the very unusual sheet of the Shut HaRamah, without going into the details, that the Goyim's din of Shev Mitzvahs Bnei Noach, of Dinim, are actually to follow all of Choshen Mishpat. That was a side point. Okay, let's back to Dina D'Machus Adina. There's a very important Rabbeinu Yonah in the Rashba, and that is that we only say that Dina D'Machus Adina, which of course we're saying applies to Mamonis, not Isser, Dina D'Machus Adina only applies between a Jew and a non-Jew. But if there's an interaction between two Jews, then we follow Dinei HaTorah, not Dina D'Machus Adina. Accordingly, whenever you have Yerusha, Yerusha will always follow Halacha and not the law of the land, because both parties are Jewish. The Ram has another reason. Since we suggested that Dina D'Machus Adina doesn't apply by Isser, but rather by Mamonos, so Rabbi Shefter wanted to apply, I hope I'm understanding this correctly, ask a Shaila before you do it, before you cough on your next get, make sure you ask a Shaila, please, the Shaila of Kfil we get to Dina D'Machus Adina. There are two reasons why a person, why we might be kof al haget. One is because they're married by Isser, or because the guy's a terrible guy, the woman's a terrible woman, whatever it is. So, can we be kofa on a get in the United States of America? So, we can't be kofa on between Adam and Malcolm, because there are plenty of, I don't know why not, but I guess everybody, you know, there are plenty of non-religious people who are married to people who they're not allowed to be married to. And so why can't we be kofa on that? I guess America, I don't know, we'll just get in trouble. But can we be kofa on a get for that bin adol l'chaveru aspect of kfiya, meaning if he's a terrible guy? So perhaps there might be the possibility of kfiya on a get, because it is bin adol l'chaveru. I'm a little confused about that point.
Yeah.
For Ben Adam Lachaver, he says for sure you cannot, because the Dina D'Machus would not allow it.
Right.
I just don't understand. I thought we said that between two
said
Jews
and
on the
plane.
Okay, fine. I wasn't clear about that. Thank you.
He definitely came out that you can't leave someone to get
what I said. Definitely said
yeah.
You can't,
and you possibly.
I didn't get that point. I didn't get that point. I'm sorry. In terms of that which we said, that Dina D'Machus Adina doesn't apply when you have two Jews, Rav Henkin said that that's only true if you have two Jews just stop having an argument. Then you'll follow halacha. However, let's say you have something that there's a Dina D'Machus Adina that was instituted with Tikkun HaMedina. For example, rent control, minimum wage, perhaps bankruptcy. Those kinds of examples, this is a very important point, these kinds of examples, even if you have two Jews involved, the renter and the rentee, or the you know, the employer and the employee, or the Malva and the Lova, are both Jews. Here, since the Dina de Malchus Adina was established to Latikun HaMedina, so the Jews are part of that same Medina that are supposed to be helped by the Tikun HaMedina of making these minimum wage legislations and rent control legislations, bankruptcy legislations, and therefore, Rav Hengen suggests that these kinds of Dina de Malchus Adina will apply even between two Jews, and therefore, Jews would be bound by rent, even two Jews would be bound by rent control and minimum wage and bankruptcy law. Of course, a person could, even though according to American law, they might not have to pay when they get money later on, it is lechatchila, it is appropriate for a person to pay, a bankrupt person to pay up later when they do have money. Okay, now, the Shach has two more exceptions to when we say that, again, we just mentioned that between two Jews, we don't follow Dina de Malchus Adina, but if Hengen said it for Tikkun HaMedina, we will. Another two cases where we will follow Dina de Malchus Adina, even between two Jews, and that, the Shach says, if there's a Dina de Malchus Adina, and the Shulchan Aruch has nothing to say. So if the Shulchan Aruch has nothing to say about a topic, about an issue, or a dispute between two Jews, and Dina de Malchus Adina has something to say, so then, follow Dina de Malchus Adina. The Chazon says, there's no such thing. Every case, you're either chayev or you're pater. So there's no such thing as the Shulchan Aruch has nothing to say. The Shulchan Aruch doesn't say about it, so you're not chayev, or whatever it is. There's no such thing as the Shulchan Aruch doesn't have what to say. The second case that the Shach says, so this will be our third scenario where Dina de Malchus Adina will apply, even between two Jews, is that if, let's say, you have a business, and your business is open to both, to all the people who come into your stores. So let's say you have a return policy. Let's say there's a state return policy. Whatever the state requires, every item that's bought in New York State could be returned for 30 days, let's say. So let's say Halacha has some other perspective. So every person walks into my store, I'm going to say, oh, you're not Jewish, so you're going to follow the state legislation. You are Jewish, so we're going to be bound by the, you know, whatever Halacha's return policy is. No, that the Shach says, we're not going to say that when we're operating with a certain umdana, and then we could say that it's ke'ilah. We know, of course, that two Jews can make it tonight. So when I operate a store under a certain umdana that we're working with the certain parameters of return policies, just that's how all businesses work in this state, so that's like the fact that I make a t'nai with every person who comes into my store, every Jew that comes into my store, it's as though I made a t'nai with him or her that we're going to work based on whatever the way things are done in New York State. It'll be like that umdana turns into a ke'ilu hisnu, and therefore we'll make even the Jews, the two Jews, bound by the Dina de Malchusa. That's the end of that point. Here I see Rabbi Shetty came back to Kfi Al Haget. Rabbi Shetty suggested that separation of church and state is ultimately to allow freedom of religion, so it ends up being Latikun HaMedina. Part of freedom of religion is that you can't be Kfi Al Haget. So therefore, according to Rav Henkin's cheshbon, that anything that's a Tikkun HaMedina will be binding even between two Jews, perhaps we wouldn't be able to be Kof Al Haget, because that which you can't be Kof Al Haget is to allow religious freedom, which is the Tikkun HaMedina. The Tikkun HaMedina, we apply Dina to Malchus Adina, and therefore, maybe this is the cheshbon that we were thinking of before, a person will not be able to be Kof Al Haget, and therefore, according to Dina to Malchus Adina, again, Me'uzah Shelo Kedin, could mamish be possible. Interesting question. Now, we know that based in Ismakin Shalom and Hadin, the Ran says that that is not only true by a Beis Din, that applies even to a non-Jewish government. And he has the story of Rav Elazar ben Shimon, who used to turn Jewish criminals into the Roman authorities. And the Gemara doesn't say that he's not allowed to do it. It says we don't like that kind of, it's not a good job to go into, for a nice Jewish boy, but it's not usher. So it sounds like it was Medina, it's not usher, to turn people over to the Jewish, to the Gentile, to the secular courts, even if the secular courts aren't going to be Malkam Ochen, Shalom and Hadin. Let's say they want to say anyone who steals gets the automatic death penalty. So that's Shalom Kedin, right? That's Machmas and Shalom and Hadin. Well, secular court says the Iran does, says the Ritva, does have the ability to do that, and therefore, if that's what they feel is appropriate, then that will not be considered Mesira. It will be permitted to turn a person over to secular authorities, even if they would kill the Jew, a fellow Jew, if that's the law of the land, as you see from the story of Elazar Reb Shimon. But there are a few parameters. In terms of Mesira, first of all, Mesira, this is a big thing to keep in mind. Mesira. What is Mesira? Mesira means that somebody didn't do something wrong, and you turn him over to have something done to him. But if a person did something wrong, that's not called Mesira. Additionally, Mesira is only when you, when we say Mesira, Mesira being Aser, Mesira is only when you're going to turn somebody over and something worse than what should happen to them will happen to them. Meaning, not just worse than what Halacha would say, worse than whatever either Halacha would say, or worse than even what the Goyim say will have. The Goyim say he should get 10 years in prison. But we know that somebody who gets 10 years in prison might also get beaten up. Well, that's worse. The secular law doesn't say the person has to get 10 years and get beaten up. So there, Mesira might, yes, apply. But if it would just be that they get 10 years in prison for something that we don't see as so terrible, that would not be considered Mesira, because that is within their parameters of Makan Velenshin, Shalom and Hadin, which is permitted. But keep in mind, this is a very important foundation. A Jew is only allowed to inform the authorities if that person who they're turning in did some violation of halacha. If there was zero violation of halacha that a person violated, there's no heter to turn the person over. If there was zero, once there was some violation, then whatever the secular, ramifications will be, even if it's more than we would think is appropriate, but then a person would be permitted to turn the person over.
Even if that violation was self-dealing what was due.
It's hard to imagine that.
And did Rav Shapiro say this in general, like he didn't volunteer the information, or he was saying this in the context of someone who's being threatened himself if he doesn't...
I think at first he said even if a person could volunteer, that's what the Ritva shows from the story of Rav Shimon, or Elazar Reb Shimon. It sounds like it could be volunteered.
But then he's
going to say, there's another point. Let's say there's a person who... But you don't have to. But then there's another point that he's going to make now, that if there will be a Chil Hashem, if a Jew doesn't testify because he's worried about Mesira, once there's Chil Hashem involved, so Chil Hashem makes it that there is no Isra Mesira, and without getting into the case, so if there's a case where a guy is losing money, and the Jew knows information, there will be a Chil Hashem. If he doesn't, then a Jew may testify, there will not be an Isra Mesira. When do we, yes, permit Mesira? And what I mean by Mesira is that the Jew will be punished beyond what is appropriate, beyond what even the halacha, the Jew, Gentile law might allow. We still do allow Mesira in that case, that's what we call Mesira. When do we allow even something terrible happening more than he deserves? It's just called Mesira. When do we actually allow that? Two situations. First of all, Makeh es Chavero. And secondly, says the Shulchan Aruch, Olin, Shin, Peches, if somebody's Meitzer es Harabim. What's Meitzer es Harabim? So the examples that Rav Shapiro gave would be like a pedophile, somebody who has a problem with ganav, regular ganav, somebody who's an abuser of different types, perhaps. That's Meitzer es Harabim. There you could do Mesira, even if you might suffer more than it says on the secular books, more than the secular legislation is, even there, for these situations, a person, even in these two situations, Mesira is permitted. Okay, that's the end of this sugya. Let's talk about Yichud in the minute that's left. Okay. So Yichud d'oraisa is only if there's one man and one woman present. There are three historical steps in how Yichud happened. There's Yichud d'oraisa, which is only for arayos. Later on, after the story of Amnon and Tamar, there was also a tikkun, a gazru based David on Yichud of a penuya, tahora, even if she's a tahora. And then a third stage in history, that Talmidei Hillel Shammai, gazru af al Yichud shel Goya. Now, the ages at which Yichud begins is, of course, only once they're Ra'i Labia, therefore a boy from age 9, a girl from age 3. The Torah's HaYichud says, the tremendous kula from Rabbi Yashiv, that Yichud is only going to be also for a bar mitzvah, meaning a bar mitzvah cannot be with a girl who's over 3, a bas mitzvah can't be with a boy who's over 9. But if you have two ketanim, a 12-year-old boy and an 11-year-old girl, there Yichud will be mutter. Similarly, a 12-year-old boy can be with a Gentile woman babysitter because she's not the baby. The Gentile babysitter is not mitzvah. The 12-year-old boy is not mitzvah, even though he's right, Libya, so that would be mutter. And the opposite, a 11-year-old girl and a 20-year-old man would also be mutter because the 20-year-old guy, Goyisha man, is not Jewish, so he's not mitzvah in Yichud. And the 11-year-old girl is not mitzvah, so she's also mutteres b'Yichud. In terms of an old person, so Moshe has the following chiluk. If he's impotent, he's not Roy Labia, then if the doctors declared him clinically unable to have Bia, then there's no issue Yichud whatsoever. If he just knows that he can't, but he hasn't been clinically diagnosed as unable to have Bia, then we will only permit Yichud Rabbanan. Very important to keep that in mind, because Yichud Rabbanan is like Yichud with a non-Jewish woman. Non-Jewish woman is always going to be Yichud Rabbanan, like we saw from the Takana of Hillel and Shammai, and therefore Filipino maid or house key or health aid would be permitted for an elderly man who is impotent. Your question about modern medicine, if that would change, great question. I never followed up. We pointed out that there's a shear for Yichud. In terms of the shear, it's important to realize that whatever time we say, it doesn't mean that you're allowed to do Yichud for less than this time. It means that if you're in a situation that will not be, that will not stay in this situation for that amount of time, whatever amount of time we'll say, that is not Yichud. But if you're in a situation where you will be locked together for these minutes, then even the first second of that will be Yichud. What are the shiurim? The Gemara by Sota says that the shear for stira, which is the same as Yichud, is litzlos beisa uligoma. So the Dvar Halacha, based on his experiments, came as little as 35 seconds. Rabbi Yashiv says under a minute is certainly fine. Rav Moshe has a great kula that says you have to add the amount of time that it takes to get undressed and dressed afterwards, and assume if they're not very friendly, the amount of time that it would take for the man to be Meshadal her to seduce her. We spoke about a sister is Aser B'Kvias, different Hagdaras of what Kvias is. Is it 30 days or is it just he doesn't have a plan? A little bit of discussion about that. Then we talked about what is Yichud, how many people constitute Yichud. So the Gemara said, the Mishnah says in Kiddushin, Isha Achas Misyachedes Im Shnei Anashim. So two men is good. Why is that? Well, first of all, there are limitations. The reason why two men is okay, because one man will be bosh from another man. That's what Rashi says. But there are a number of limitations to this kula of two men. First of all, they must be ksherim. Or at least one of them has to be kosher. They have to be ksherim. And secondly, this heter is only ba'ir. But ba'derech, you're going to need an extra person around. Now, this means that there's a kula that a... there's two men, both are ksherim, both are from boys. A girl can come over for a date in their apartment. That would be mutter, because there are two men there, even if the front door is locked. We talked about different parameters of what makes a paritz. We had different shitas, or Moshe was machmir, even if a person thinks they're not going to be able to withstand such temptations. Rabbi Yasha mentioned television, which we discussed. What happens if you have a situation of prutzim, or people who aren't religious? Then you will not have this het of two men with a woman. Then you will need harbe anashim im harbe nashim. What is harbe anashim with harbe nashim that will be necessary for prutzim? For example, somebody at work where there are non-religious or non-Jewish people there. So then there's a three-way machlokas, either two men, two women, or three and three. And the middle shita is two men and three women, that would be permitted. Even if everybody is involved, is prutzim. Now, lechatchila, we should aim to be machmir to allow three men and three women, but b'shas hadchak, you might be able to be meko for even if it's only two men and three women. Keep in mind that this is only according to Ashkenazim, because the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch passed in that everybody unless you're gigantic chassid yisod olam, like the greatest of the Amoraim, everybody's considered a paritz. And therefore, for Svardim, since we're all prutzim, the only time that it will ever be mutter for to have yichud is if you don't have yichud. You have harbe anashim im harbe nashim, like we just mentioned, with the numbers that we just mentioned. So for Svardim, you will not have a heter of two men with a woman, you'll have to have harbe im harbe. Just like two men and one woman cannot be alone at night, you need another person there, in case one of them falls asleep. Similarly, we're machmir baderech, we're also worried somebody, if there's a trip, one of the two men might go to the bathroom, you'll be left with one man and one man. There always must be a third man present, baderech. So both at Alayla and baderech, you need an extra person. When we say Laila, tremendous kula, is not when it's shkia or it's seis or tichla yagam hashuk. Laila is whenever you people go to sleep. So if in your room no one goes to sleep before 2 a.m., so that means it's not considered Laila until 2 a.m. and you're allowed to have yichud. You're allowed you will not need a third person till 2 a.m. So Allah Hamayis, if there's a car driving from the mountains to the city, and they're going to be baderech, you cannot have two men and one woman, you need three men and a woman. To finish off, what happens if you have one man with two women? So Rashi says that we're worried. That's going to be us, the Gemara says. That the Mishnah says that's us, because Nashon dayt and kalas, and therefore he might taka bibol both of them. Rashi says, but if there were three women present, it's physically impossible for one man to be boel three women, and therefore Rashi holds that one man with three women, whom he can never be boel physically even, will therefore be mutter, and that is the kula that the Rama has. It's a very important kula, that one man is permitted to be misyached with three women. Rashi says, because it's impossible for him to be misyached with, to be boel them, therefore the others will be embarrassed, and they'll talk about it. There are some other explanations that we gave. This kula of one man with three women, the Dvar Halacha says that even if all the women are prutzos, all the women are gayos, if you're working in the office and you have three secretaries or you have three bosses, and they're all Gentile women, and it's just you, that will be mutter. Therefore, if you have three nieces, you could babysit your three nieces. What's a three-year-old? Obviously, it's only a question. However, there's a limitation to this kula of three women of Nashim Harbe, and that's if you're Asak of Imha Nashim, and the Rav Yashu explains, only if you're exclusively work with Nashim. But if I teach in a girls' school in the morning, and if I teach in a yeshiva in the morning, and I teach in a girls' school in the afternoon, that's not considered Asak of Imha Nashim, because I'm also involved with men. Next, in the final discussion of today, we're not going to have time for Rabbi Sobolowski's electricity share, is Pesach Pasuch L'Rishus HaRabim. Here we have a gigantic, raging machlokas, whether the kula of Pesach Pasuch L'Rishus HaRabim is Shema Yikanes or Shema Yir'eh. If we assume that it's Shema Yikanes, well, then the door could be closed. If it's Shema Yir'eh, the door has to be a bit ajar. So, this is Taka, how Rabbi Kveger assumes that the door has to actually be a little bit ajar, and therefore, the kula, so we have Rabbi Kibbe Seger says the door has to be a bit ajar. However, the Rishonim seem to say, the Rashba, Rabbi Nayona, say the door can be closed as long as it's unlocked, and as long as Shem Yikanes, that will already be okay. Each one has a kula. If you hold that the door has to be open, which is a chumri, you have to leave the door actually physically ajar, that has a kula that this is going to be mutter all night long. However, if you're Makel, and I say the door could be closed as long as it's unlocked, will only give you this kula as long as there are people walking around in the street that might open your door, which is only as late as people are walking around in the street, somewhat like, you know, Tichel Regem HaShuk, depends on your neighborhood. The kula of people, of leaving the door unlocked, which I think is the Mikra Hadin, I would be Machmir in a Doraisa case, and in a Durabon case, I think it's appropriate to be Makel, is even if you don't really think that somebody's going to walk in, somebody's going to open the door, the Radvaz nevertheless is Mekel, because it's Emas Rabim Beteva. I think the Chazunish had a lesson, Emas Rabim Alav Beteva, you're scared somebody might walk in. Even if there are numerous doors that have to be opened, if they're all unlocked, the Radvaz is still Mekel. And what is, that's Pesach Pasuach, what's the Rishus HaRabim? Here the Dvar Halacha is Mekel, that even though there are as few as three people in a Chatzer, your door is, doesn't have to be actually open to a Rishus HaRabim, it's just open to three people or to a couple. A couple, a married couple would be Matzil also, that would be Mutter. And then we finished off talking about doctor's offices, where Reb Moshe said that if you're the last person in the doctor's office, you're going to be in trouble. You can't be the last person in the doctor's office if the nurses aren't going to be there. And therefore, you have to make sure there are three other women. There are three women around, either you and a nurse or two, a secretary, a nurse. And I'm sorry we don't have time to finish this properly and to go through the halachas of electricity with Rabbi Sobolovsky. Hopefully you work on those on your own. My suggestion for studying is take what we did in the Chazar Shears, go through it with notes, let the outline of this Chazar Shear be your outline to know what to focus on and to give you the structure. The Chazar Shear will be enough for a lot of it, will not be enough for everything. And hopefully the outline of the Chazar Shears will just aim you and focus you, realize there are some things that are tangential you don't really have to focus on at all. Other things will give you a little bit. But work with this and the notes from your shear, and I'm sure you'll all do wonderfully.
What will be the structure for the test?
The test will probably be... two questions on each shear.
Right.
And you'll be able to do, let's say, 20 out of 24 or something like that.
20 out of 24.
I don't know exactly. Something around that.
You have to answer at least one for every shear?
Probably not, no.
Is this going to be on by tonight?